I'm Emily Alphen Johnson, VPR Digital Producer. Your time is valuable, so we've edited this episode for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today we are broadcasting live from VPR Studio One with a live studio audience. Welcome. We're all here, of course, for Robert Siegel. Robert Siegel is the elder statesman on NPR's All Things Considered. He's been hosting the show since 1987, which you can very quickly calculate is 30 years. That's a pretty good run.
Mm-hmm.
And early in his tenure on the show, he traveled to Germany to cover the news when the Berlin Wall came down. This piece aired on All Things Considered on November 12, 1989, while Robert stood in the Potsdamer Platz, an area that was bisected by the Berlin Wall.
The Kurfürstendamm, West Berlin's Champs-Élysées, has been closed to automobile traffic for much of this weekend. The human traffic has been just too intense. The Kudamm, as it's called here, has been the scene of certainly the most historic Sunday stroll in the city's history. Hundreds of thousands of East Berliners crowded the sidewalks, gawking and gaping at this neon-lit thoroughfare. Children catching a first glimpse of the electric train display in the window of Wertheim's department store. Adults catching sight of the billboard for the blue movie erotic cinema theater. Most of the stores are closed for Sunday, but that hasn't stopped the strolling. East Berliners have not really come west to shop. They've come to explore, to relish the sensation of being here, and also to remember the day when the city was divided in the summer of 1961.
Boy, that voice is instantly recognizable, isn't it? You know that's Robert Siegel.
Hi.
Robert Siegel has actually been in radio.
Even I recognize that
voice. I know. Does it sound weird to you, Robert?
Yes, a little bit, yeah.
Well, Robert Siegel is with us today, obviously. Robert, it's a real pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
It's great to be here, and it's wonderful being a guest on a radio show.
Yeah, except you have to answer all the questions. I have the easy job today. So, and I'm not going to make it easy on you at the beginning. So yeah. Let's dive into some of the news that NPR has actually been a part of in the last few days. And yeah. You have not been hosting All Things Considered. You've been traveling here. You were speaking last night in Middlebury. So yeah. This is not something that I expect you've been following as closely as you might otherwise have, but it's in the NPR family. So,
yeah. And
let me give some background for people who haven't been following. NPR's news chief, the highest person in the newsroom, Mike Oreskes, has been accused of making unwanted sexual advances. Two women came forward saying that he kissed them, forcing his tongue into their mouths, and this happened before he was at NPR.
But 20 years ago.
Right. And the allegations have surfaced more recently. And a producer at NPR said that he did not physically assault her, but had a sexual conversation with her that made her very uncomfortable. Oreskes resigned yesterday, and there was a fairly remarkable conversation that many of you may have heard on All Things Considered last night between NPR CEO Jarl Mohn and host Mary Louise Kelly, and she really grilled him about when NPR knew what and did it do enough. Mohn said that rumors had swirled for the couple of years that Oreskes had been at NPR, but that he couldn't act on rumors. What did you know? What rumors were swirling around that you heard about Oreskes' behavior?
I had heard the rumor, and no more than that, that there had been some complaint against Mike Oreskes, and I never knew who that was. There was a question that was raised, which is, had Mike done something that was a fireable offense and for which he was not fired? So I heard that concern raised, and I guess the way Jarl answered it in his interview with Mary Louise Kelly last night was that the 2015 incident had been dealt with to the satisfaction of the woman on staff, and therefore he was, I didn't know this, but he'd been reprimanded and that was behind us. That was the extent of what I knew. This stuff from 20 years ago when Mike was at the Times, I'd never heard of. So,
does it surprise you at all to know that this kind of...
Yes, it surprised me. I mean,
surprise you specifically about Mike Oreskes?
Well, I'd heard this rumor about, you know, behavior at NPR, nothing very specific, but the story of his grabbing a couple of women and kissing them against their will and all that. I find that surprising. I hadn't assumed that was part of Mike's character. And I should say that in the 3 years, is it 3 years or 2 years? I can't quite remember.
Two or three, I can't remember
that,
either.
That Mike has been in charge of NPR News. You know, he's done a good job. He's been a good, serious journalist. So I was surprised and not pleasantly by what I gather Mike has publicly apologized for, so implicitly he's confirmed doing it.
Does it surprise you, though, to know that this behavior that you've been reporting on, others have, it's, since the Harvey Weinstein allegations have come out, there is really a flood of women who've not only been sharing Me Too about their own personal experiences, but suddenly powerful men in American culture and politics and media being called out, called to the floor, named, and in many cases being fired or forced to resign. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, organizations hope and perhaps believe that it's not happening within their organization.
I think it's as you've described it, and obviously, at some level, I'm not surprised by these things. We report on them, and we hear about them from friends and family in the course of living a real life. On the other hand, when somebody you know and whom you haven't talked about such things with is accused of such behavior, it's still surprising. No, look, this is a serious one of the most surprising developments of this year is that when somebody is accused of such behavior,
something happens.
Something happens. More women express themselves and say, "This happened to me." And upon hearing that, two, three women, or in Weinstein's case, God knows how many, have charged such a terrible behavior, people get fired and they do get shunned. And I hope that's an encouragement to women who've been victimized and a deterrent to men who would behave that way.
We got a note, actually, from Keith in Burlington on this, who says, mm-hmm. In the last couple of days, NPR has covered itself with the Mike Oreskes story. Can you address the challenge and importance of doing that?
The challenge is very great. I was the news director at NPR. It wasn't a vice presidency at that time, before I escaped into Radio Heaven and the job that I've had for the past 30 years. And when I came in, we were in the midst of a financial crisis, and we had a budget that was way we spent a lot more than we brought in. Let's put it that way. And we had to lay off about a third of the staff, and member stations were up in arms. The Congress was investigating, and I was brought in to be a news director.
No pressure.
Yeah, and it was very important to me. I said, look, we'll take our best reporter and put him on this story. It was Scott Simon. We didn't yet have a program for him. That was something that I developed during my stint as a news director. And Scott covered it. I remember at one point I was told by an acting president to take Scott off the story. And I told him if that was the case, I was going back to London, where I still had a couple of months more left on my contract with NPR. And they backed down, and Scott continued to report on it. It was very difficult. You're reporting on people who are your superiors, who are your members of the organization, and in some respects, the hardest part was that the CEO of NPR, who had really messed up and written a terrible budget, was the one whom I was, I think, closest to of any CEO. This was Frank Mankiewicz, and when I think of Frank, and many years later Kevin Close, who actually showed you could be a very good president of NPR, proved that was possible. Those are the two people I was closest to, for sure, and it was sad to be covering picking through Frank's poor job in that last year that he was president. So, yeah, it's very difficult, and you got to do it.
When it's not just covering yourself, but in a situation like the one that we're in now, where, I've been reflecting on my own experiences, certainly, as a flood of women around the country talk about Me Too, and there's not a single woman I know who's made it to adulthood without some degree of some of this. And so, in some ways, it affects all of us. And then when there's an incident in your own personal and professional circle, that affects you. How do you deal with that breakdown of the wall in stories like this or others where your humanity is bubbling up in addition to your job?
It's very challenging, and for example, the story that brought this to the public was a Washington Post story. Let's talk about this in journalism terms. It was an account of two women relating events that happened 20 years ago and who didn't go on the record with their names. And I checked with a female colleague who's an awfully good reporter and said, "What do you think we would have gone with that?" And I
mean, if it had come to you,
if it had come to us, would we have gone with with two anonymous allegations from 20 years ago? And I'm not altogether clear we would have. I think that that's and at the moment there's a great deal of, I think, among journalists, because we're human beings, of guilt for not reporting out things earlier or not pursuing rumors that in some cases were rumors of felonious behavior in the Weinstein case. And so it's important to approach these things. I mean, it sounds odd, but not just as a sensitive human being, but also as a journalist. You know, what rules do I bring from my trade to deal with this issue? And if those rules don't work, should we be rethinking them? But how do I approach this as a journalist? So I thought that Mary Louise Kelly, who's filling in on All Things Considered, I thought she did us proud in her interview of Yarl Mohn yesterday. She raised a question which the staff feels, which is, you know, was it the Washington Post piece and this being made public that led to Mike's departure? And if the Post hadn't gotten this information, would NPR have broken with him? Jarl denied that that was the case, and presented a different narrative of it. But I thought Mary Louise did us proud, and David Folkenflik, who had to cover us, did us proud, even to the point that he had known about the NPR incident. I didn't know this. He and his editor, who did not report directly to Mike, had concluded that what they knew, since it was about a dinner conversation that made an employee feel very uncomfortable, it was resolved satisfactorily, to her satisfaction, that is, by NPR, and that Mike, unbeknownst to me, was reprimanded. Folkenflik, a good, strong, tough reporter, decided that's not a national news story. That may be bad behavior, but it's not a national news story. Hmm. And I couldn't argue with that.
Robert, we have a question from Charlie in Vienna, Virginia, who says, what does your typical day look like? Safe to say this is not it.
Fly across the country, give a speech in on a campus and be on a radio station. My typical day is wake up, absorb the news, read a couple of papers at home, and figure out what I'm doing today, go to work, attend the show's meeting at 9:30 in the morning, and by 10 emerge with some sense of what, who knows, three interviews I may have to do for that program, or if I have a piece that's working that we've been working on so far, how, you know, should I advance that? Has it been edited yet? And then various people come and bring me clips or send them electronically, and I'm reading in on a variety of completely unrelated topics, some of which I know something about and some of which I'm completely ignorant. And by 1 o'clock or so, when the interviews start happening, I typically feel that I'm well enough prepared to ask a half dozen questions of the people I'm talking to, discuss with the editor and producer how we're going to cut that 8-minute interview down to 4 minutes, and then by 3:30 have written the opens to the half hour of the program, at least half of them. I'll go into the studio with whoever, Audie, if she before she went on family leave, or Kelly McEvers in Culver City, or Ari, and we pre-recorded 3:45 those bits. And then, as everyone else is going nuts outside, we're in the studio, it's very calm, and we just have our copy green-lighted one item at a time, and I look at the engineer and, you know, read him the news.
So. Do you do that? One time, I used to work at Marketplace, and yeah. The host, David Brown, who I worked most closely he always said that when he was speaking, he pretended he was talking to his mother, and that she was about 3 or 4 feet away in the room with him, and that's who he was talking to, and so that he could have the warmth in his voice that he wanted to have, and not feel like he was shouting. And it sounds like you have a warm, collegial relationship with your engineer.
Well, the engineer, but also with my father, I did for many years. The NBC journalist Frank McGee once came to journalism school when I was a student. And he told this story. And he said, you know, for him, in those days, the evening news on NBC or CBS would reach 20 million people, 30 million people. He said, the thought of talking to 25 million people is paralyzing.
Yeah.
There's no way to do that. So McGee said, I talk inside my head to my father, because the way I would relate a story to him is the way I want to talk to the audience, and that way in my head I'm talking to one person. And radio station program directors, I think, since the invention of microphones, have been telling people, yes, you're going to talk to lots of people, but you're talking to them one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, McGee's advice was to take it one step further. You're talking to them one at a time. Pick one person in your head, and you know that's whom you're talking to. So I do that. Yeah.
And your father never says, Robert, don't tell it that way.
No, because I was picking a very easy mark in my head because my father would be very impressed. Oh, it's terrific, Robert. So I'm really impressed with that, Robert. So I was being very easy on myself.
That's helpful.
Would have been harder with my mother, I think, to talk to my mother.
Raisa in Essex Junction wants to know, what story do you regret not doing?
Well, that's a good question. What story do I regret not doing? I don't know. I'm having trouble with that one. I guess at some level, I regret not having gone to Iraq at some point during the war. I thought we were very well covered in Iraq. I wasn't particularly eager to go, although I think we had one trip scheduled. We may have had one trip scheduled that got pulled down, but that would be a regret.
My regret is much more mundane, I suppose, but I really want to do a show about circumcision, and none of the male producers on staff will produce it. It's been 8 years now I've been trying to do this show.
I'm not sure I would read the intro to the piece that came out of that.
We are talking
people are
today.
Driving while they're on.
I know, but...
And you can't have them crossing their legs while they're driving.
That's true. But the cultural implications. We could actually, why don't we just do this? We've got about 40 minutes left, so this is the show we're going to do now for the rest of the hour. It's live radio. You know, as you know how this works. I get to do whatever I want, right?
I gather. I'm getting that impression.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and I'm here today in VPR's wonderful new studio, Studio One. We have a live audience, and we're talking today with NPR's Robert Siegel. What a wonderful day to be able to have you here.
I'm delighted to be here.
We have a lot of comments coming in from people who just want to thank you for your years of service. Robert is retiring from NPR in January of 2018.
You're welcome, all of you.
Jean says, I can't imagine not having Robert Siegel on ATC anymore. Kate says, I will miss you, Robert Siegel. Thank you for 30 years of great service. All things considered will not be the same without you. And then we also heard from Marianne, who says, I was so sad the day I learned you planned to retire. Yours is one of my favorite radio voices. Calm, measured, intelligent in every situation. Perhaps this is my own pet peeve, or maybe it's indicative of the direction the news is going, but I always cringe when I hear the host of a radio news program greet their interview subjects, some quite esteemed, with, hey there. Are we losing decorum, Marianne says, and she doesn't think that you have.
There is, by the way, in our conversations with our reporters, I have noticed that below a certain age, all hosts will say, hey, Mar. That'll be the opening to the...
And even you.
No, I won't, because I'm above that certain age. But there's a cutoff there. There's a cutoff, and I think the actual on-air greeting of a certain, you know, below a certain age is, hey. So she's not making that up, yeah.
Is there also, are there some NPR contributors who, when you say goodbye to them, you know that you have to actually not allow them to say goodbye back because they're so terse in their goodbyes that you have ways that you know to interact with your longtime people that, oh, this person always says, yeah, so you don't say goodbye and ask them for a reply. This is a belief that I have.
I'm sorry to disabuse you of this, but I can't think of a different way of saying we sometimes...
Cokie Roberts.
Well, Cokie's on Morning Edition, you know.
Yes, you don't...
I hired Cokie in the Stone Age when I was an editor at NPR, and she's a friend, but I haven't had an on-air conversation with Cokie in a zillion years, so I can't answer that. I will say that the... one of the odd experiences of the past few months has been interviewing someone who's not an NPR person, but is some expert professor or, one case, former CIA director or whatever. And I say, so-and-so, thanks for talking with us today. And the answer is, thank you, and I'm really sorry to hear that you're stepping down in January. I hope there'll be some... And, you know, we don't want to hear this. I mean, I've had some long goodbyes from people going on about... you know, thanks for all these years you've been hosting All Things Considered.
And you want to cut them off?
We don't want
to hear it?
Well, if it's not live, we cut it off. And we let's take one more goodbye before we...
I have always imagined you interviewing me and trying to think about how when you say hello, because Robert, you, I have noticed over the years, you'll say, and we're here with Jane Lindholm. Hello, Jane. And I would start to say, hello, Robert. And you'd say, it's nice to have you here. You know, there's always a second addendum to the hello.
Yes. And someone in Baltimore heard, and I became aware of it, that I would say very often, welcome to the program, that I would pause after welcome. Which I hadn't. Once she brought it to my attention, I realized I've been doing this for 20 years. I can't even stop. So even once it was brought to my attention, so I would say, Jane, welcome.
Yes, nice to be here. And then you'd continue.
Then I'd
yes,
go there, yeah.
Yes.
And what I'm looking for, by the way, what I'm looking for after that pause is a clean point where, if when we edit this interview, we can start with a different question if need be. I want there to be a clean pause so that if the first question is a total misfire, and you go on for 3 minutes talking about what you want to talk about.
Circumcision,
probably, yeah. Then I can phrase a second question down the line that says, apart from circumcision, Jan, which I know you're very interested in, and that will cut smoothly. So,
good.
I'm sorry I said that last week. Yeah.
We want to know, Peter and Lyme in particular wants to know, how do you stay neutral in a politically polarizing era?
You tell yourself, my job is to be neutral in a politically polarizing era. And you try to, with all the politically charged interviews you do, be prepared with good challenging questions so that whatever the person, wherever he or she comes from politically, someone would not say you're giving the guy too easy a ride, and you try to do that because it's what we do, because that's a part of the trade.
Jim, who is written into our website, says Robert Siegel.
Yeah,
you are especially perceptive in your commentaries about music and interviews with musicians. Will music continue to be a special interest in your retirement?
I'll always listen to music, and I'm mostly a classical music listener and a jazz listener, certainly I don't know what, you know, if I'm going to do any broadcasting about it, yes, I mean, music to me is it's odd, you know. I've spent an entire life doing news on the radio, but for me personally, still the greatest thing that you get on the radio is you can turn it on and there's music, and you can actually turn it on in hopes of hearing Bach at that moment, and then devise other ways of programming it. So yes, it'll always be a part of my life.
Let's go to Gordon, who's calling in from Northfield. Hi, Gordon. Go right ahead.
Hey there. Does that defy my demographic, Jane? I feel that the closest we're going to get to a circumcision show today is to note that your guest has been on the, well, cutting edge of great journalism. For
yuck.
And mazel tov for that, sir.
That's your circumcision commentary right there. Yeah. It's mine too, yeah.
We have something in common called WKCR-FM. The Columbia University radio station, where you preceded me by a couple of years as news director. I know from having heard many, many of the tapes from that time, and I know many were lost, never to be found again. But you covered, you know, then on the Columbia University campus, a very turbulent time in America, with a very, in those days, I think it would have been Nixon, right? And now we've got Trump, and you've also got a lot of pushback, a lot of activism fighting, you know, that this administration and the way people were pushing against Nixon in those days. Can you talk about how that experience, you know, how being able to dip into that, that experience informs your reporting?
Yes. First I should say, in 1968, I was a senior at Columbia College, Columbia University, and it was the scene of huge demonstrations, and WKCR-FM, the radio station where I spent more time than any student should spend at a non-academic location on a campus, we covered it. And we went live for round-the-clock coverage. It culminated in a huge arrest. I think it was at the time the biggest mass arrest in New York City history of 728 people. One of them, a woman I hadn't known at the time, but later married her. She's still my wife. And KCR, that was a very important experience for me for a number of reasons. But first of all, by that time in 68, Nixon wasn't yet the president. It was still Lyndon Johnson. And when I recently, not recently, I guess last year, did a sort of an exit interview with Joe Biden, I agreed with what he said about division in America, that as bad as things are in 2016, he was saying, they're not as bad as they were in 1968. At that time, we had, what happened at Columbia was foreshadowing of what would happen at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in the summer of 1968. That year, George Wallace was running as the American Independence Party candidate for president, and his ideas were as radically and angrily populist as anything of the Trump campaign of 2016, I think more so since the issue of to what degree we should desegregate was actually a live issue still in 1968, and Wallace would not be segregated by anybody. We had riots in cities, in black neighborhoods of American cities. We had terrible divisions over both domestic and foreign issues over the war. And it was a terribly unsettling time. And for me, that national mood of uncertainty and chaos had been glimpsed during our week at Columbia when students were occupying buildings, the university was at a standstill, we were waiting for the cops to come in and evict people. We were covering it, and we were actually providing some sorting out, some explanation of what's going on for people who were deeply puzzled. And I said, this is where I want to be. I mean, I want to be when chaos is all around us. I'm not particularly interested in being a participant in the chaos, for better or worse, but I like the idea of knowing what's going on, being plugged in, and being of service to people so that I'm doing something useful, because if not, I'd be walking around the campus not knowing what I should do with myself. And we were very well, I mean, our job was very well received, and I decided, boy, if I could actually make a living doing that, you know, that's what I want to do. So it worked out.
Yeah, nearly 50 years later.
Nearly it worked out, yes. Yeah.
You know, one of the differences, you talk about the polarization there and this cycling back to a real time of polarization, but one of the differences perhaps, and I wasn't alive then, so you can school me on this, but, you know, the idea that the media, that person that you wanted to be, who's reporting the news, who's helping people understand what they need to know and stay calm, that in so many cases right now, people are being told that you are lying to them.
Yeah.
You know, that there are forces. I mean, just in what the president said earlier this, or I guess in October now, it's frankly disgusting the way the press is able to write whatever they want to write. And people should look into that.
That darn First Amendment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is that a difference that you're now not only trying to report the news and gather the news, and there are changes in the way that's done, but changes in the way what you're doing is perceived?
Well, I think that the President Trump's attacks on the media are of a different nature, of a different magnitude than what we've been accustomed to. So far, oddly, they have been more verbal abuse than actions. I mean, there was a threat to challenge NBC's license, which actually NBC doesn't have a license. I mean, it owns broadcast properties that are licensed. It was not a very well informed attack. As I would point out that in the Nixon years, a man whom I admired a great deal and later helped bring him to NPR twice and counted him as a friend, Dan Shore, was covering the White House during the Nixon era, and Richard Nixon had the FBI investigate him. They were looking for something under the pretext of it being that they were considering him for a job. Yeah, think about it. Dan was later on the enemies list, and Nixon's behavior toward Dan contributed to one of the counts of impeachment against Richard. So far, Donald Trump's done nothing like that. His administration hasn't prosecuted a leaker under the Espionage Act, which we've had in this century from other presidents. So far, the question, as I like to say, is do words speak louder than actions? Is it more damaging to have a president who's creating a lot of noise and undermining people's attitudes toward the media than any physical step? I mean, this is a man who may attack the fake media, but he's calling up the New York Times to tell them. He's not calling us up, alas, but he's calling up the New York Times to say that Washington Post story about how I was paid, that's wrong. So he's he recognizes the importance of media when it suits him. So
yeah, and that's it, when it suits him. I mean, we are in an era now where politicians can go on Twitter, they can go on Facebook Live, they can go directly to the people who they want to speak to, bypass the media altogether, and in doing so, often bypass the critical questions, the tough reporting that's already been done that reporters want to press politicians on. So how do we collect news in an era where if a politician wants to say, I'm not going to talk to any of you, he or she doesn't have to?
Well, I think one of the big differences between the way, and I'm speaking we now very broadly of all of us journalists, which is probably presumptuous on my part, but there's a big difference now and say back in the late 60s or the Nixon era, which is that today it's considered normal for a news organization, which is in this case epitomized by a cable news channel, let's say, to present the gathering act of what we used to think was what a reporter did before the reporter gathered enough information and then put a story on the air. Now we're likely to hear the individual component interviews that might go into a story live and presented in full. And we don't expect a finished product from journalism. People, at least some people think, want to see the process of news gathering. So I'll just take you back to recently when John Kelly, General Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, gave his version of what Representative Frederica Wilson said in Miami a couple of years earlier. It was vivid, it was detailed, and what it was, I think, was a perfect recollection of what John Kelly felt during a talk by Representative Wilson. It wasn't what she said. It wasn't an accurate reflection of what she said, but it was an accurate reflection of what he was feeling, obviously, throughout the speech that she gave. And I think that this is a warning against everything being live. We want to see everybody talking before. You know, don't save it up and edit it and present it to me later. I want to be plugged into the news as you're gathering it. Well, you can hear people with great conviction, total sincerity, and perfect memory of what they felt at the time, hold forth and be fundamentally wrong about things. And so media, I think, in the desire to have the audience share in the process of news gathering rather than receive the product of news gathering, we do invite this kind of criticism.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and I'm here in VPR Studio One with a live audience here to help us talk with Robert Siegel, the longtime host of All Things Considered on NPR. Robert is in Vermont. He gave a speech yesterday in Middlebury for the Vermont Humanities Council, and he's generously agreed to be here with us for the hour. Gary is calling in from Irisburg. Hi, Gary.
Yes, good afternoon.
Hi.
My question is whether you think that NPR is doing the level of political journalism, particularly investigative journalism, that we're getting from the New York Times, the New Yorker, and the Washington Post. And I'm referring in particular to the fact that NPR covers many stories, but are they doing the investigative news in regard to the Trump administration, the Russian connection, the Trump cabinet, and those sorts of things?
Gary, it sounds like maybe you think not.
I'm a little disappointed in the last year, yes.
I wish I could say yes, but it would, as Richard Nixon once said on a tape, but it would be wrong. I think that the Times, the New Yorker, the Post, the Washington Post, and in broadcasting, sometimes NBC have done a lot. They've been a lot more robust and productive in their digging into the Trump administration than we have. I think you're absolutely right that when an interesting story does break, we make sure it's heard about on NPR. But we haven't been competitive with those groups, and the Wall Street Journal, where I believe there were complaints by the staff that the paper wasn't being productive enough in investigating. I really at that point picked up and have done a good job as well. So, you know, it's I could go on and on about the levels of staffing that we have and how we use them, but I'm not going to argue with Gary about that.
And you think that it should? I mean, there could be an argument that NPR is a different thing, that
serves
a different
need. No, I wouldn't make that argument. I think that NPR has reporters who have lots and lots of deadlines to meet every day and in two different media, and we are much in that sense. We just don't have that many people to be willing to spend a day to generate what might make a very good newspaper story, one solid sentence that you've been able to confirm from multiple sources. We haven't had that. So,
let's go to Stephen calling in from Hartford, New York. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Good
Hi.
Afternoon to you both. I'm rather troubled by our president making obvious lies and then accusing everyone else of lying. And the question you just asked of Mr. Siegel, how do you remain neutral in a rather polarized interview environment, made me want to ask regarding a question that was posed on, I believe, VPR yesterday by, as I recall, an NPR interviewer, but it could have been from another media outlet. I don't recall, but it applies nevertheless. The question is this. A question was posed regarding the diversity green card program, which the president then attributed to Senator Schumer, calling it a Chuck Schumer problem. It's known that this program was put into place by Bush II, not Schumer, and that Schumer didn't agree with it. And yet the interviewer, when Trump said, yeah, this is a Chuck Schumer problem, went right past it, didn't stop, and say, but there is clear knowledge that this wasn't attributable to Senator Schumer. Almost tacitly agreeing, therefore, with the lie that the president was foisting upon us.
So to Stephen's point,
yeah.
Then, when do you call out an untruth, and when specifically the word lie has been a key word in news, when you call a lie a lie, when you call something an untruth?
Well, first, I think, and again, I've been here for the past 36 hours, so I'm pretty sure the question was not put to Trump by an NPR person.
Yeah.
It was by a reporter for, or maybe it was at a photo op in the White House. But I think, look, this is a hazard of live interviews, or of not just live interviews, certainly live interviews, but even whole unedited interviews. You go into them prepared as best you can for whatever might come up. But who yesterday, before Donald Trump said it, would have thought I should be armed with Chuck Schumer's role in the? Now, you should have been briefed on what the immigration program was, how this guy got into the country, because that's a question we're asking all the time as suspects are identified in alleged terror crimes. But my guess is that was a media event very much made to the liking of the president, which is a quick Q&A. Nobody standing there in the White House at that moment is going to be prepared in all the different subjects that the president might comment on and might misrepresent. He's unlike anybody else we've ever covered in that regard, and it would be a very, very incredibly well-informed interviewer who could know all the details that Donald Trump might misrepresent in the course of a live interview. It's tough. It's tough. Yeah.
So I want to ask you a little bit about your retirement. And I know that Robert Siegel is retiring. But
I've heard that.
But might we at some point...
I can confirm that.
You can confirm. Good. But might keyed-in listeners sometime hear the return of a man named Bob Charles?
God, I hope not. I was Bob Charles for, I think, half a year in Babylon, New York. WGLI, a commercial radio station, where the program director said, we'd like to, we don't like to have names that might offend anybody. I was happy to have an anonymous, to not be identified in the job. But I learned to be a morning newscaster and a talk show host, to the extent that that I did it at all. But no, you will not hear from Bob Charlton ever again. There was a very good left-handed New Zealand golfer named Bob Charlton.
Well, and speaking of Robert Siegels, I was going to ask you about some of the movies you've been writing in Hollywood in the last few years, but I understand that's a different Robert Siegel.
It's a different Robert Siegel, yes.
What are you planning to do come January?
I don't know, less. I'm planning to do less, and at the moment, it's still quite vague. I'm very happy that I've hit my 70s in a position where I don't have to be somewhere every day, and I can choose what I do. Maybe I'll see more of my children and grandchildren and my wife. I don't think she's so happy about that. But find new things to be interested in doing. I don't want to spend my 70s and I hope I have 80s milking and trying to extend what's been a great run. And it's been a wonderful time, and I'm as lucky as you can be about getting a job and being able to stick with it. And I don't want to turn into the world's leading expert on me. That's not of interest to me.
I can see, though, some listeners, given what we've been hearing, who would appreciate if you would stick around and just be an expert on you. They would like to see you stay into your dotage.
Well, I'm glad you recognize that my dotage has not yet begun.
Yes.
But I would say that the business of sounding reasonably well-informed in doing that job entails a lot of homework and a lot of preparation, only to learn that actually the interview we thought you'd be doing, we're not doing. So forget about everything you just learned about the railroads and whatever, and learn instead about dentists doing this.
I'm familiar with
you know this.
Work,
so
yes.
It's a demanding job, and I certainly don't want to reach a point where I think I'm doing it badly. I don't want to reach a point where I think I'm mailing it in. So,
what's your hope for NPR then, moving forward, if you get to send it off?
It's much more than a hope. It's a great confident belief that this is such a more important, secure, large organization than the place that I came to work at 40 years ago, thinking I'd be there for maybe 2 years, and then I'd get a real job someplace. It's such a more important part of American life today than it was then, and there are so many incredibly bright people. I mean, some of us wonder, would we ever be hired at this place today if we had applied? So I'm greatly confident that it'll continue to be both dependable but also experimental and trying things. I guess most of them are now happening on podcasts, but I hope also on the air, figuring out what's the best way we can work with this wonderful medium of sound.
Well, as a listener, I guess you'll get to enjoy it now.
I intend to.
Robert Siegel, thank you very much
thank you
for
very
being
much,
in our
Jane.
Ears for 30 years and for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me here today. Thank you all. Thank you all. Thank you.
Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Matthew Smith. We had production assistance today from Michelle Owens and Nina Keck. Our digital producers are Emily Alphen-Johnson and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed the program. We had additional assistance today from Chris Albertine, John Billingsley, Peter Engish, Frank Alwine, and Ty Robertson. Our managing editor is Sam Gail Rosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks to you out there for listening, and thanks to you in here for listening. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.